You know, the cinema is a form so-called of escapism. There are many ways to explain that. But I think, certainly when you watch a Greenaway film, you only know you're doing one thing. You're simply not looking at a window of the world. You're not trying to replace some funny notion of realism. Realism is absolutely impossible to be able to... God's done it already. Why should we try and do it again? But to make a form of what could be described as cinema, you're only watching a film. But that's not, you know, an underside occupation. It's an extraordinarily sophisticated occupation.
That was the director Peter Greenaway there on the renowned Soviet film pioneer Sergei Eisenstein, who's the subject of his new flamboyantly colourful film. He'll join me in the studio shortly. Also ahead, we'll venture deep into the jungle with Disney's sweeping new take on a much-loved children's classic, The Jungle Book.
I started explaining what the song is and what the new lyrics I wanted were, and I said, well, Louis now a gigantopithecus, and he says, stop right there. He says, say that word again. And I said, gigantopithecus, give me a pen, let me write that down. And remember, this is the guy who wrote Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, so he loves words, and he starts riffing on gigantopithecus. He says, give me a shot at this.
From Mexico to the wilderness of India, a jungle of treats awaits us today on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London, I'm Ben Rylan, and I'm joined today by one of cinema's most admired talents. His many forays on the screen have attracted as much praise as they have fascination, admiration, and perhaps provocation too. Peter Greenaway is, of course, the BAFTA-winning director behind classics such as 1989's The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, and The Pillow Book in 1996 with Ewan McGregor. His latest project plays a little bit like a tornado of super-fast cuts, quadruple screen scenes and oddly timed history lessons while one's virginity is done away with by a very handsome Mexican.
You have 20 days left on your visa, Mr. Eisenstein.
We have to bring this thing to an end.
What, Mr. Kimbrough, is this thing?
What the hell does he know about film production? Poison coffee?
Eisenstein in Guanajuato is energetic, to say the least, but it also seeks to portray the legendary filmmaker during an emotionally distraught period. Despite repeated boasts of working alongside the likes of Charlie Chaplin, the film picks up on the director's story after he'd been rejected by Hollywood. He's in Mexico to work on an ill-fated new project, but it's his relationship with his guide that proves to be, in the words of our lead, the 10 days that shook Sergei Eisenstein. Peter Greenaway, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House today.
My pleasure.
Eisenstein in Guanajuato. Now, there are so many ways to look at the genius work of this filmmaker. You've chosen, at least for now it seems, to focus on his relatively short stint in Mexico. What was it about that particular period that made you hone in on that?
Well, I think, you know, this isn't a flash in the pan sort of idea I sort of dreamt up 18 months ago. I've been fascinated by Eisenstein probably all my career. Discovered him when I was an adolescent studying painting here in London. And I had no idea even at that tender time. I was, 17 in 1957? So there's a way in which I've been thinking about this man and what he stood for a very, very long time. I think in the 120 years of cinema we've had so far, there have been very, very few really important visionary film directors. I think you can count them on the fingers of two hands. And I would put Eisenstein right at the very top. Certain advantages. He's working in the 1920s, when perhaps people didn't really understand what cinema was and were trying hard to find out. He was obviously alive and around 1917 Russian Revolution. And although Stalin is often the villain in his life story, Stalin also gave him extraordinary resources, like half the Red Army, for example, in order to make movies. But Russia in 1917, 90% of the people are illiterate, and both Stalin and Lenin certainly realized that to try and persuade and propagandize with pictures was obviously a very, very good idea. But I think there's a particular genius about Eisenstein experimenting. He made his great movie Battleship Potemkin when he was only 26, which for me is always still now absolutely amazing situation, because he virtually came from zero and made this, what I believe is the first masterpiece of Western cinema. And the times, you know, incredibly heavy. Huge amounts of excitement, political and cultural. I've just had a big exhibition in Red Square about the Russian avant-garde, all those people like Kandinsky and Malevich and Mayakovsky and so on and so on. So I've always been fascinated and interested in this period. And I think that whereas most people were stodgily illustrating narrative, think of Griffith's Intolerance, etc., here was Eisenstein, this great Soviet director, actually making what I would only describe as cinematic poetry. And I'm here in an establishment where apparently you're all text, text, text. And I always think there's a great, great antagonism at work here. You know, the Old Testament says in the beginning was the word. Rubbish, not true. In the beginning was the image. And you cannot have a word without an image. And we've created a cinema which is incredibly text-based. Every film you have ever seen started life with the text. Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, supreme examples. But this is also true of... you name it, Almodovar, Lars von Trier, all the famous people. Just as Godard said, unfortunately, we have created an industry that demands a text before it has an image. And I think Eisenstein was the first man to buck the trend, to indicate there was superlative opportunities in trying to recreate an image which was primarily indeed about pictures and not words. So, a hero. And I've stuck with him and been curious about him and practically been to every place in the world he's ever been to. And I never really wanted, particularly felt no great reason perhaps to make a film about him. And I've often thought that films about films are incestuous, but then you see Fellini's 8.5 and realize it's possible to use this genre for extraordinary possibilities. And then about 10 years ago, I began to make feature films about my heroes, made a film about Rembrandt, a film about Vermeer, a film about Goltzius. We're about to make a film about Oscar Kokoschka, and I'm currently making a film about the Romanian sculptor Brancusi. So it's sort of all coming home to roost. So why not come right up against the mark and make a film about a filmmaker? And that's the movie you've seen.
Well, you speak there so wonderfully about how whether it's text or images that come first. And really, I mean, just looking at your latest film, it really treats the image with such a feeling of love and affection. And it almost feels as though the cast and crew here were sort of shooting the film while wearing roller skates. Nothing really stays still for very long at all. Just looking at a figure like Eisenstein, who obviously was so well respected for his innovative use of editing. Some people say he really invented the concept of what we call editing. Those two things, the way you've treated them, is that some sort of homage to what he was known
yes,
for?
Yes, I think so. I think the original ideas when I began to think about the possibility of making this film probably about 3 or 4 years ago was really to make a documentary about the film that was a total failure, which is Que Viva Mexico. And it was a failure not because he didn't shoot 500 miles of film, a huge amount of film, but he was never, and you're absolutely right, never allowed to edit it. And I think his supreme talent, and certainly for me, the most important person in the film business, is the editor, the man who puts things together. And it was as his talent, which was totally denied, that created, unfortunately, this suggestion indeed of a failure. But aren't failures sometimes far more entertaining than successes?
Indeed, indeed. And it's funny how so many films that were once considered failures are now considered absolute classics as well, which I'm sure you're no stranger to, having just worked on this project. But just looking at some of the stylistic choices you made in Eisenstein in Guanajuato, there is one moment that really stuck out at me when the two leads are exiting a cemetery. And it almost feels as though it looks like it's been shot through some sort of fisheye lens, and they appear to be coming out of a corner in the cemetery, but then the entire shot slowly unfolds, quite literally unfolds in front of us. And, I mean, it's a fascinating way to go about what might have been just a run-of-the-mill scene, people going from one place to another. And yet it's kind of removes us from the feeling of watching just a film in which people move around, and reminds you that you are indeed in the cinema. A lot of filmmakers would be a little bit afraid to remove people from the film and remind them that they're watching a movie. Why did you feel that you really, I suppose, had to remind people of that?
Well, you know, the cinema is a form so-called of escapism. There are many ways to explain that. But I think certainly when you watch a Greenaway film, you only know you're doing one thing. You're simply not looking at a window of the world. You're not trying to replace some funny notion of realism. Realism is absolutely impossible to be able to... God's done it already. Why should we try and do it again? But to make a form of what could be described as cinema, you're only watching a film. But that's not, you know, an underside occupation. It's an extraordinarily sophisticated occupation. And I want to use as many devices and all the vocabularies, certainly the digital world, you know, since 1983, along with 120 years of cinema we've known heretofore. And you're very right, I think, to pick that subject matter. And although I've been already rude about your text, if you listen to the text at that moment, we're talking about coming out of a cemetery, but death is engulfing them in the way that that wall creeps around them. And they're also talking about the pressures of life in Russia. And I don't think there's any point making a historical film unless you're talking about now. So those walls are not only engrossing you and entrapping you and enslaving you in terms of your inevitable end, I'm sorry you're going to die, but it's also a reference to a political situation. And I think, you know, the ideal movie has to be that really exciting interaction between form and content, the medium is the message, etc., so that what you're seeing is what you're hearing, is what you're feeling, is what you're knowing. So the extraordinary sophistication of really good cinema is possible of containing all these sorts of meanings.
We'll come back to Peter Greenaway in a moment, but I want to take you on an expedition deep into the Indian jungle now. But don't be afraid, we've got a giant grizzly bear and a fierce black panther at our side. It's the age of remakes, they all say. Hollywood has run out of ideas. Every time a new take on an old text is wheeled out, we tend to go over these same arguments. In reality, of course, Hollywood has been remaking movies for almost as long as the medium has existed. The original version of A Star Is Born was made less than 10 years after the debut of the talking picture, before it was remade twice. A fourth version is currently in the works at Warner Brothers. Disney's new take on The Jungle Book, however, is really not so much a remake, more of a reinterpretation of Rudyard Kipling's wonderful collection of fables from 1894. And if we're going to take another walk down familiar territory, we might as well do a mighty fine job. Fortunately, director Jon Favreau has reached for the moon and grabbed hold with both hands. We meet young Mowgli as he's performing a set of tree-climbing acrobatics that would make any parent wince with worry. Of course, Mowgli doesn't have any parents. He's been raised by Bagheera, a jet-black panther, and taken in by a friendly pack of wolves. Tree climbing is all part of his recipe for survival in the wondrous jungle landscape. But not everyone is so enthusiastic about the idea of a man cub assimilating himself in the animal kingdom. The arrival of Shere Khan, a ferocious Bengal tiger, puts everyone on edge. He believes man is not welcome in the jungle, and he can smell Mowgli's presence. Thanks to the combined efforts of Michael Bay and Zack Snyder, overuse of CGI may well be headed for its own place in the book of medically defined addictions. Mercifully, director Jon Favreau displays an expert's grip on how to use effects and imagery to enhance the impact of the story. The scenes and settings here are quite simply some of the most beautiful special effect constructions I've seen in a very, very long time. The addition of 3D could have easily been an afterthought, as it so often is. And yet here, it actually enhances the banquet of colours and all manner of curious creatures that quite literally buzz, creep, and crawl their way off the screen. Make no mistake, this is a film about talking animals. But the world illustrated for us is so effective in its persuasion, I challenge any naysayers not to be lassoed by its charm. Even more impressive is how intelligent the overall message is. Much of that is down to Kipling's stories, but the adaptive text here is so clever with its allegories on racism, immigration, and acceptance of outsiders. There's also two songs from the original Disney movie that, despite being hinted at, feel fresh and surprising when they actually happen. Perhaps it might have been nice to see the film embrace its musical tendencies with a little more wild enthusiasm, but the two numbers that do make the cut are a lot of fun. Much has been made of the cast assembled here. Ben Kingsley, Idris Elba, Lupita Nyong'o and Bill Murray as Baloo. They're all excellent, particularly Scarlett Johansson in a brief but magnificently chilling appearance as Scar, an enormous and terrifying snake.
I'll keep you safe. Just you and me, sweet thing.
I remember seeing some pretty scary movies when I was young, but I also have strong memories of feeling so involved with the characters of films like The Lion King. The themes here are dark and complex, but not so much that they won't be understood by younger viewers. In fact, it may even have all the bare necessities of a classic. Well, if you happen to be catching a screening of The Jungle Book, you'll almost certainly wander out of the cinema humming the absurdly catchy tune I Wanna Be Like You, which of course appeared in the 1967 original. Let's hear now from director Jon Favreau on how it came to find a place in the new reimagining.
I had worked with Richard Sherman back on Iron Man 2. I had met him through John Debney, who was composing for that film as well. He did Jungle Book. And we wanted to write a theme for the Stark Expo, as Howard Stark, Tony Stark's father, would have had it back in the old days. And Howard Stark was an amalgam of different characters, but one of the influences was Walt Disney. And so the idea that he had a Disney-like theme for his expo back in the 60s was really exciting. And of course, we thought the best resource for that would be Dick Sherman, because he wrote a lot of the classic Disney tunes from the parks and from the films. And so I met Richard Sherman, who pitched on his piano that version of the song. I thought it was wonderful. And now here I am a few years later doing, with John Debney, working on Jungle Book, and the idea that we got to pull Richard Sherman in to this to help collaborate, because he was such a big part of the original film. And the opportunity arose when I changed the character of King Louie to a creature called a Gigantopithecus. There were no orangutans in the Indian jungle. But thousands of years ago, there was a species called Gigantopithecus, which probably looks something like an orangutan. And as soon as we did that, we wanted to change the song, I Want to Be Like You, to match that new character. And so we brought him in to write new lyrics. And it was so funny, because as I was pitching him, now he's an older man, and you don't know if he's still on top of his game. If you don't know him, you know, you just don't know. And I sat and talked to him, always was polite. I started explaining what the song is and what the new lyrics I wanted were. And I said, well, Louis now a Gigantopithecus. And he says, stop right there. He says, say that word again. And I said, Gigantopithecus, give me a pen. Let me write that down. Gigantopithecus. And remember, this is the guy who wrote Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. So he loves words. And he starts riffing on Gigantopithecus. And he says, give me a shot at this. And he comes back the next day. And not only did he use it once, he used it twice and found words that rhyme with Gigantopithecus. So this guy has still got his edge like he did whatever it was 50 years ago when they wrote the music for the old version.
Director Jon Favreau there, getting all ridiculous with Disney's new Gigantopithecus. Up next, more from director Peter Greenaway.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
This is the cinema show on Monocle 24, presented, of course, in association with MUBI, the curated site of cult, classic and award-winning film. Subscribers here in the UK can currently catch the wonderful 1954 classic from Billy Wilder, Sabrina, starring Audrey Hepburn, and Roman Polanski's Descent into Madness with 1976's The Tenant. There's also a global exclusive for subscribers everywhere from Spanish filmmaker Luis López Carrasco with 2013's El Futuro and 2014's Android's Dream, produced by Carrasco and directed by newcomer Ion de Sosa. And you can tune in to next week's show to hear from our Madrid correspondent in his conversation with Carrasco. And of course, don't forget our special treat, a whole month of MUBI free. Head to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle to redeem that one. Peter Greenaway is still with me here in the studio. Before we continue, though, let's hear another clip from Eisenstein in Guanajuato. This is Eisenstein as he's receiving a rather unwelcome visit from Mary Craig Sinclair.
Give me some coffee, will you, dear? Sir Guy. Hunter and I wanted to know how you are doing, how you are getting along. Oh, we have put your latest film rushes through the laboratory in California, and I must say, we all say, they are truly splendid. Albert says so, and George says so too. Oh, I'm sorry. Albert Einstein and George Bernard Shaw.
You have shown my rushes to all these people when I have not yet seen them myself?
Well, you couldn't, could you? There are no Mexican laboratories worth knowing, are there? And we didn't want to disturb you in your good works, in your long hours. Though, Sergey, it is 10 o'clock in the morning and you are still in your pajamas. Yellow pajamas, no less. And in bed having breakfast?
Mm-hmm. With your friend.
Now, I want to talk about the way you treat nudity in the film, because it is, look, watching this film, it did occur to me at first that, oh, people are going to find this quite graphic and confronting. And then it struck me that, well, maybe if this were women up there who were revealing everything about their bodies, we wouldn't be so surprised. And maybe what I was surprised with most is that we've got two characters here who are a gay couple and whose sexual endeavors we get to see up very close in, I suppose, what might be slightly peculiar ways. The history lesson during the sex was unexpected.
But funny. I hope you laughed.
I did indeed laugh. Most people in the cinema with me laughed. Not uncomfortable at all. Why do you think that cinema, maybe filmgoers, maybe just the media at large, why are people so afraid of the penis?
I know. I always think. I live in Amsterdam, sex capital of Europe, yes. And there's a way that the three dangerous words in, I suppose, our civilization are homosexuality, abortion, and euthanasia. These are all readily available in Amsterdam and have been since 1945. So, you know, especially American Puritanism, like, you know, the idea, I was encouraged by my producers to see if I can get an A-list Californian. Can you imagine an A-list Californian actor? It maybe wouldn't be the actors or often courageous people, even in California, it would be their managers and their agents. Don't touch this, don't touch this, etc., etc. For all, obviously, the shock reasons that are hidden in your question, the extraordinary Protestant, very largely, Puritism, Puritanicalism, which is part, I suppose, of the American psyche, is extraordinary. It always amazes me that people have these extraordinary problems. And, you know, these three words I mentioned probably anywhere in the world. I mean, obviously not Baghdad. You wouldn't talk about homosexuality in Baghdad with a very loud voice. But you go to Toronto, you know, you go to Melbourne and people run away or say shut up or turn red. So there's great sensitivity about this little phenomenon. The last film I made called Gulsius was very much about these sort of taboo subject matters and how taboos are always deeply disadvantageous and are based on all the wrong reasons and incredible prejudices. And surely cinema should be in the propaganda vehicle to explain, to open up, to open doors and windows about all these disadvantageous characteristics of notions of civilization. I have to come a bit cleaner here. I'm, as an art student, you know, we drew the naked figure Wednesday afternoon, Saturday morning. So for 4 or 5 years, it became very, very obvious that, you know, nudity was a basic situation. And you know, most American picture-making people take their clothes off prior to sex. And we know that 90% of the time we take our clothes off is probably to have a shower. And I don't think people, you know, have a shower wearing their underpants, do they? But that's, you would seem to think that's what happens in Californian cinema. It is ridiculous.
When we do see the penis in the cinema, it doesn't seem to, well, it doesn't, the world doesn't seem to have ended just yet. I mean, it almost feels like Ewan McGregor's penis has achieved legendary status because of what you did with it in The Pillow Book. Michael Fassbender's penis has now achieved the same sort of status because of the film Shame. That may well happen to the actor here that plays Palomino. It always seems that when something like this, we get a film that portrays nudity in such a confident, casual way like your film does here, that people might have they might feel a little bit awkward, have a bit of a giggle, and then we watch the film and we move on and no one really minds all that much. Why do you think still in 2016 that nudity for some reason still seems to hold some sort of political power?
Well, we've had 2,000 years of Christianity in the Western world and that's very much responsible. I think in a curious way, which doesn't sound too simplicistic, it's sometimes a question of meteorology. You know, there's the concept of the naked and there's the concept of the nude. Nude is positive, naked is guilty. And that might have something to do with the sun. You know, in a curious way, the Mediterranean is a lot freer than perhaps it is the beaches of Norway, for example. Although maybe I've chosen a bad example there. But I mean, there are complications. And, you know, I do think, and I'm sure you would agree, that in a curious way, things are getting better. And I think our freedom to talk and discuss and be comfortable with homosexuality is part of that phenomenon. And it's noticeable now, isn't it, in advertisements, for example, even on British television, you know. Menstrual blood, for example, is no longer blue. You know, the sort of curiosities that we have to get rid of.
Although I would argue that we're still a little bit behind as far as the male nudity is concerned, and I still think that's a bit of a paradox.
It's true. But I think, you know, there is also a line of films, and you must have your own list, who've opened people's eyes, you know, Lynch's Blue Velvet, Bertolucci, Last Tango in Paris. There are key movies which are inched us forward, and we must continue to do that. And I'd like to think that Eisenstein and Guanajuato is part of that push.
Baby steps, indeed. And just finally, you're not done with Eisenstein just yet, are you?
There's more. No, I think, you know, my great problem, and we waited sort of 9 months, human gestation period, actually, to find the ideal actor. And I began to despair we ever would. There are so many films and photographs of Eisenstein, we know what he looked like. He had to be 33 for all that games of playing with the death of Christ and Alexander, and St. Augustine saying we're all going to heaven age 33, because there's no point going where age 1 or age 99 will never enjoy it. So there's a concern that the figure, okay, he's... I mean, when I first started talking about Eisenstein when I was a student, people said, you mean Einstein, don't you? So there's tremendous confusion, because we play that joke in the film as well. But, you know, the amount of interest and I suppose the whole phenomenon that we can now look at the world's history by pushing a button and seeing a DVD, which you certainly couldn't when I was a student in the 1960s, has opened up our knowledge about all these sorts of information and phenomenon. So we do live in a different world. And next year is 1917, when we'll be memorializing the Russian Revolution. And it's time. It's time. And there's exhibitions now in London about Eisenstein's pornographic drawings, and they are pornographic and really still now probably quite shocking, certainly because a lot of them are very sacrilegious too. So sacrilege and pornography, I mean, Jesus Christ masturbating on the cross is pushing the boat out a bit, but it's again edges and edges and edges. And I think, you know, all artists necessarily offer alternative vision. They have to be provocative. It's part of their obligation. And you think of all the artists you've ever seen, and though now a lot of them seem very, very safe. Caravaggio, for example, incredibly popular. You know, his paintings were turned down time after time after time. He would give the Virgin Mary dirty feet to imply she came from the proletariat. And Mr. Church would say, no, 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 you cannot give the Virgin Mary dirty feet. We have moved on a little.
Indeed. Peter Greenaway, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure too. Thank you.
And that's it for this week. Whether it's a young boy lost in the jungle or a 33-year-old man lost in his own thoughts in Guanajuato, innovations in the cinema play such an important role in telling a good story. And while it may be true that too few filmmakers today pay close enough attention to the work of renowned painters, every now and then a film bursts through the cinema screen and proves even the hardest cynics wrong. What would Eisenstein make of Disney's jaunt in the jungle? Well, we can only wonder. Today's show was edited with wild enthusiasm by Nina Norek and researched by the vine-swinging Yolene Goffin. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me by sending an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show swings back in next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.